Hello and welcome to Wattcast. My name is Roger Watson, and these podcasts are dedicated to readings of various articles that I've had published in newspapers and magazines. They reflect my views on politics, the pandemic, and current affairs. Thank you very much for listening. Today's podcast is going to be a bit different from usual. It's not going to be me reading one of my articles or pontificating about anything, in fact. Today's podcast is a recording of a lecture given by Toby Young, Editor-in-Chief of the Daily Skeptic and also the General Secretary of the Free Speech Union, which I invited him to deliver to the National Conference of University Professors at our annual general meeting. This was held in the Gordon Museum of Pathology at Guy's Hospital in London on the 28th of February 2023.
Okay, so when I was brought up in the Church of Scotland or the Kirk, whenever we sang the hymn, the Lord's My Shepherd, inevitably the minister would get to this hackneyed sermon based on the 23rd Psalm, which was the Lord's My Shepherd, I shall not want. And he always mentioned the two dogs or the 12 ducks that followed you around in your life, and they were goodness and mercy which follow you all the days of your life. Well, our speaker today has two dogs that follow him around, but they're not goodness and mercy, they're controversy and opprobrium seem to follow Toby around wherever he goes, but he treats those two things with a great deal of equanimity, I must say. I'm very glad he's here to speak to us today. Very difficult to sum Toby up, and I'm only going to take about a minute to do this, but Toby is, amongst many other things, a journalist, an activist, an entrepreneur, a best-selling author, star of GB News, which is where he's going after this. He's been played by Simon Pegg in a movie. Not many people can claim that one. He's editor-in-chief of the Daily Skeptic. I know that several people in the room have read that. It kept us sane during lockdown. He's an accomplished podcaster with two podcasts every week, London Calling and the Weekly Skeptic, which are well worth listening to, both amusing and informative. He's a blogger at the Pride of London blog about his support for Queen's Park Rangers. Nobody's perfect, but and he's also had a go at being a stand-up comedian at one point and so many more things. But today he's here in his capacity as the founder and director of the Free Speech Union. And it's in that capacity that I'd like to ask Toby to speak to us for the next 45 minutes or so on free speech in UK universities. So Toby, over to you.
Thank you, Roger. Thanks very much to you and to the National Conference of University Professors for inviting me. I feel very honoured. I don't think I've ever been asked to give quite such a distinguished lecture before, so thank you very much. So as Roger said, my name's Toby Young, and I'm, amongst other things, the founder and general secretary of the Free Speech Union, which is a not-for-profit membership organisation which stands up for the speech rights of its members. And I set it up in 2020, and we're about to celebrate our third anniversary. It was in February 2020 that we set it up. And it's grown quite quickly. We now have 16 employees, combination of part-time and full-time, and 11,000 members. And we do various things. We organise events. So we've got an event coming up, an arts forum for people concerned about attacks on freedom of expression in the arts, including literature. Kathleen Stock is going to be giving a lecture at that event. We carry out research and publish briefings. So we've just published a briefing on the Worker Protection Bill, which I'll come on to a little bit later, because it will affect universities quite significantly. And I'm not sure the sector has been adequately consulted about it. And that's one of the things the Free Speech Union is lobbying the government to do, to press pause on the Worker Protection Bill so all the stakeholders affected by it can be properly consulted. And I don't think, certainly, the higher education sector has been properly consulted. nor have any other sectors. We also, we're about to launch something called the Ian McTaggart Programme, which will be a grant-giving programme, and will invite students and student societies that are doing their best to defend free speech on campus to apply for fairly small grants, debating societies, free speech societies, and we'll also be awarding a small number of grants to researchers, to PhD students, master's students, who are doing research which we think relates to free speech. But it'll mainly be, I think it'll be exclusively actually for people who are members of universities to apply for these grants, and we've got about £33,000 to give away each year. So we hope that'll make an impact. And we hope to create a network of pro-free speech students and organisations, a national network, in due course. But what we mainly do is casework. That is, people reach out to us if they've got into trouble because they've said something they shouldn't, even though in some cases they weren't aware that they shouldn't have said it. And they've been placed under investigation or they've lost their jobs, and they're often at their wit's end, had no idea that the consequences of saying the wrong thing could be so serious. Typically it's not something that breaches the law, merely something that breaches a speech code, whether in the workplace or at a university, in an institution, a professional association. And so far in our three-year life, I checked this morning with our data guy, and we've dealt with 923 cases, and of those, 138 were either students or academics, so about 15% of the total are members of universities. To give just one example, Roger here, after writing, co-authoring an article for the Daily Skeptic last year, in which, amongst other things, he challenged the evidential basis of mask mandates. And of course, that's now not as contentious as it was then, post the publication of the latest iteration of the Cochrane Review. Even the New York Times last week ran an editorial challenging the evidential basis of mask mandates. But when Roger did it, it was more contentious. And as a consequence, someone complained, and the Nursing and Midwifery Council placed Roger under investigation. And so you reached out to us for help, and we wrote to the investigating officer to say why we didn't think you should be placed under investigation and possibly be facing a fitness to practice hearing, because you had merely entered into what should be a legitimate public debate about the government's pandemic response and whether it got it right or not. I mean, there is a public inquiry currently underway into that very issue, so why you should be penalised in any way for contributing to that national debate is puzzling. Anyway, they haven't yet responded to our letter, even though I checked this morning and we sent it in November. But I'm afraid that is fairly typical. Academics in particular, who are placed under investigation, are plunged into an interminable bureaucratic process, which we often find the university authorities themselves don't fully grasp. And often we manage to get people off by pointing out that university authorities haven't followed their own elaborate procedures, some of which, sometimes they don't know which procedure they should be following, because they're sometimes being updated and they're not quite sure which one's live, which one applies. They often get caught out because they're following the previous iteration of the procedure and there's a subsequent one that they've seemingly unaware of. Anyway, it's a bureaucratic Kafkaesque nightmare. You're often not told what it is exactly you've done wrong, because they don't want to get the people who've reported you into trouble. They don't want you to be able to identify them. As many people who've gone through this, I'm sure Roger will be able to say this if he comes out at the other end of it completely unscathed, it's not what happens at the conclusion of one of these processes, it's the process itself, which is the punishment. Interestingly, I checked with our data guy this morning to find out which university has produced the most cases that we've dealt with to date, and it is Durham. And we've dealt with 15 separate cases at Durham University, both students and academics, which is three times larger than the next highest number of cases at a university. I'll give you one example. I shall give you a couple of examples of cases we've dealt with at Durham. There was one student. He was a slightly unusual young man. He was the first person in his family to go to university. He was accepted to study politics. He had a diagnosis of autism. And we often find that the people we help sort of give the impression, at least, even if they don't have a diagnosis, of being somewhere on the autistic spectrum. And I think the reason they're more likely to get into trouble than people who aren't on the spectrum is that they have difficulty understanding unspoken rules, unwritten speech codes. And it's often these unwritten rules that they trip up on. They also seem to, in my experience, have a kind of naive regard for the truth. They think the truth will protect them. That if they haven't said anything factually wrong, even though they may have breached some unwritten code, said something that's a breach of campus etiquette, that will protect them. The fact that they haven't got anything wrong will protect them, when often it doesn't. Anyway, this young man was invited to participate in a chat room which was set up for politics students who were incoming, but not yet members of the university, to try and make friends with the other people who'd been accepted to study politics at Durham. So he expressed some of his unfashionable views. As a Catholic, he wasn't very keen on gay marriage. He was also a passionate Zionist. And he expressed these views quite trenchantly in this forum. And remember, this was before he became a member of the university. And as a result, some of the students in the forum, absolutely horrified that someone who held these unacceptable views could be on their way to Durham, complained about him. And when he got there, he was placed under investigation for the things he'd said before he'd got there. And that's not unusual either. So we're currently looking after a philosopher at Oxford. You may be familiar with the case, Nick Bostrom, who stupidly, I think, decided to fess up to some of the more contentious, outlandish things he'd said in the distant past to try and spike the guns of the offence archaeologists before they found them themselves. And he revealed some of the things he'd said 26 years ago in an unmoderated chat forum when he was at the LSE, not at Oxford. But as a consequence, he's now been placed under investigation by Oxford University, even though he didn't say it when he was at Oxford. Same with this guy, was investigated for things he'd said before he became a member of the university. And after going through a lengthy process, he was eventually expelled from Durham. We helped him appeal that expulsion, and we also complained on his behalf to the Office of the Independent Adjudicator for Higher Education, and she upheld the complaint, ordered Durham to reinstate him, as well as pay a fine, compensation to this young man. And I got a gratifying email from him the other day. He's now graduated, and said that he's now embarked on a PGCE course and is preparing to become a history teacher, and had it not been for our help, he wouldn't have been able to do that. One other example at Durham, Professor Timothy Luckhurst, you may remember this case. So he's the head of a college at Durham, South College, very distinguished journalist, he invited his former roommate and old friend Rod Liddell to give an after-dinner speech at South College. Rod was his usual outrageous self. Some of the students present Googled Rod. They'd never heard of him. They Googled him, looked him up on Wikipedia, and decided that it wasn't safe to listen to him. So they staged a walkout before he got up to speak. And then afterwards, when he sat down at the end of the dinner, they then started barracking Professor Luckhurst for having invited him. Didn't he realise that inviting someone with these sorts of views into their home, which is how they describe South College, he was endangering their safety? and endangering the safety of vulnerable students. And Tim engaged in a kind of robust exchange, and his wife joined in, and the students felt that he wasn't suitably contrite. He didn't abase himself at their feet and beg for forgiveness, which is, I think, what they were expecting. So complaints were made, and instead of dismissing these complaints, the university, needless to say, initially suspended him and placed him under investigation. We pushed back, they lifted the suspension, the investigation went on. And I don't think the university have to this day revealed exactly what the conclusion of the quite lengthy investigation was, but I think because they don't want to enrage the students, but suffice to say that Professor Luckhurst is still there, and still teaching, and still the head of South College. So we've got, as I say, about 13 open cases at universities at the moment involving universities. One is a lecturer at the Open University called Almut Gaddo. She is a gender-critical feminist, and in the intranet used by lecturers at the Open University, she drew attention to what she felt was the introduction of gender identity ideology into teaching materials, I think, in the humanities, which she thought was quite contentious and had no place in a humanities course. And because she raised this objection in an internal intranet, not publicly, she was dismissed for gross misconduct. So we're helping her take her case to an employment tribunal. Incidentally, we have an enormous number of cases involving gender-critical feminists who've been punished in some way for expressing their gender-critical beliefs. It's extraordinary how ferocious the Inquisition against gender-critical feminists across the board is, not just in universities, but within the NHS, schools, every walk of life. In some ways, it's been quite helpful for the Free Speech Union to for this group of people to suddenly find themselves at the wrong end of various outrage mobs, because until we started looking after numerous feminists, we were thought to be a kind of right-of-centre organisation, even though it is a non-partisan organisation. Most of the people we ended up helping tended to be right-of-centre, because if you express right-of-centre views, you're much more likely to get into trouble than if you express left-of-centre views, not exclusively, but predominantly. So it was quite helpful for the Free Speech Union to suddenly be deluged with requests for help from all these, for the most part, left-wing feminists who've suddenly found themselves under attack merely for expressing their sincerely held and perfectly lawful beliefs. We're also looking after a couple of academics, one in Scotland, one in London, different universities, who have asked us for help because they've been instructed by their departmental heads to say how they intend to incorporate decolonisation into their course materials. How are they going to decolonise their curricula? How are they going to try and undo hundreds of years of white supremacy, which apparently is embedded in their reading lists and their coursework, even if they're teaching physics or chemistry? They've pushed back and said, is there anything we can do? We're not sure that we ought to prioritise decolonisation when we're teaching pathology, for instance. Is this a breach of our academic free speech? And we've written to two vice-chancellors, this is in the past week, saying that we do think the insistence that they change their course materials to reflect this current ideological fad, which incidentally has been imported wholesale from America. So ironically, these departments, these universities have effectively been intellectually colonized by woke activists at American Ivy League universities by embracing the decolonization agenda. Anyway, we've pushed back and pointed out that we think that insisting they do alter their courses to incorporate this very contentious ideological viewpoint, that the university would be in breach of their statutory duty to uphold freedom of speech under Section 43 of the Education No. 2 Act 1986, and it may also be a breach the university's public sector duty to foster good relations between individuals based on their protected characteristics, which of course include religion and belief. And we think it also may be a breach of Articles 9 and 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights. So we think there is some scope, if any of you have been asked to incorporate decolonisation into your curriculum materials, your reading lists, and you're not comfortable doing that, get in touch, because we think there is some scope to push back. We're also dealing with a very recent no-platforming case. So Claire Fox, Baroness Fox, was due to speak at the Debating Society at Royal Holloway, but the invitation was rescinded after pressure was applied by the student union. And the argument the student union made is this would be a breach of our no platform for hate speech policy, because Claire Fox has said she doesn't think trans women should be admitted to women's refuges, accommodated in women's prisons, should compete against biological women in sports like weightlifting. And that's hate speech, according to Royal Holloway Student Union. So she's been no platformed. And it's ironic that the latest victim of no platforming should herself be a member of the House of Lords, given the assertion of many peers in the recent second reading debate about the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill, their assertion that there is no free speech crisis in Britain's universities. And when Claire was no platformed by Royal Holloway, we did rather mischievously think, well, actually, this may be quite helpful to our cause, because next time, when the bill is debated again in the House of Lords and a peer stands up and says that the free speech crisis in Britain's university is a malady imaginaire, Claire will be able to pop up and say, I've just been no platformed. It's not in my imagination. It happened to me a few weeks ago. Many of the peers in that second reading debate cited a stat produced by Wonky, saying that of the 10,000 external speaker events in England in 2019-20, only six were refused, and four of those were due to faulty paperwork. But actually, more recent data compiled by the Office for Students show that of the 19,407 external speaker requests or events at English universities in 2020-2021, 193 were rejected, up from just 94 in 1920. But I don't think no platforming, how many people are no platformed each year at universities, is a reliable measure of the health of free speech in Britain's universities. I mean, we know from numerous surveys that huge numbers of academics are self-censoring. I think that's a much more reliable measure of how much tolerance there is for dissenting points of view in Britain's universities. So a survey in 2017 carried out by UCU found that 35.5% of academics at British universities are self-censoring, compared to an EU average of 19.1%. And as the authors of that study, it was a pretty large sample too, it was over 3,000. And as the authors wrote, self-censorship at this level appears to make a mockery of any pretense by universities of being paragons of free speech, and that of being advocates of unhindered discourse in the pursuit of knowledge, unquote. And of course, self-censorship is much higher among those with conservative views. According to a survey by Legatum last year, academics with conservative views are twice as likely to self-censor as academics with left-of-centre views. And I think one of the reasons various HE panjandrums on the benches in the House of Lords got up and said, there is no free speech crisis in Britain's universities. This is a culture war trope dreamt up by the Daily Telegraph and GB News. It's because they all have conventional views. Their views are on narrative. They are not dissenters. They believe in net zero. They believe in the decolonisation agenda. They think that their universities are riddled with white supremacy and that we need to address that as a matter of urgency. They are completely on board with the current war in Ukraine. It's in these areas, it's not that in universities there's no discussion, there's no debate. It's that if you happen to have dissenting views in a narrow range of areas on a few key issues, war in Ukraine, pandemic response, climate change, racism, if you express dissenting points of view on that small cluster of issues, then you can get into trouble. That's where there's no tolerance. That's where you almost commit blasphemy by expressing a dissenting point of view, you breach an unwritten blasphemy law, as Roger found when he said that he didn't think the evidential basis for masking was as robust as it might be. Blasphemy. How can he say that? We're all four square behind masking. That's why we've ordered all our students to wear masks. And all, except for on the campus, you have to wear a mask. How could dare he question the evidential basis? Does he want children not to wear masks and get COVID? That's the thinking. And the reason I think these peers stood up and said, no, it's a figment of the Daily Telegraph's imagination is because they've never experienced any attempt to censor their views because their views are all with the narrative, not counter-narrative. I think the problem is that often we find the argument made by the students in the case of Timothy Luckhurst, that if you allow someone to express points of view we find disagreeable, even upsetting, that will endanger our safety. It's like a perversion of J.S. Mill's harm principle. J.S. Mill's harm principle, everything should be allowed unless it's going to cause somebody else harm and then it should be restricted. They're arguing that allowing Rod Liddell to speak causes them harm, causes vulnerable groups in the audience harm. And it's not quite clear whether they mean it's going to physically endanger them, or whether it's going to just cause them psychological trauma. They're always a bit vague on that, but nonetheless, it's harmful. There is this kind of culture of extreme safetyism that's become embedded in universities, and I think it comes mainly from students. Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff, in their book The Coddling of the American Mind, blame it on poor parenting. Parents mollycoddling their children, cocooning them, protecting them from challenge, being overprotective. So the children grow up unable to cope with challenge, unable to cope with hostility or trauma of any kind. So when they encounter it at university, they become slightly hysterical and say, are the people in locus parentis over us, the university administrators, the diversity crats, they should be protecting us from hearing these disagreeable and offensive and upsetting things because we don't know how to cope with it. We've never had to cope with it. We can't cope with this kind of challenge. They haven't built up any resilience, any antibodies to challenge, including intellectual challenge. And that's why I think it's true of the UK too. Whether they're right about it being rooted in overprotective parenting, I don't know. But the culture of safetyism has definitely become embedded in British universities as well. A June 22 report by HEPI, some of you may remember, found that 79% of students believe, quote, students that feel threatened should always have their demands for safety respected. 61% said, when in doubt, their own university, quote, should ensure all students are protected from discrimination rather than allow unlimited free speech, unquote. The Higher Education Bill, when it becomes law, I think will make things marginally better. In England, anyway, it only applies in England, as I'm sure you know. And the reason I think it will is not because it introduces more robust legal protections for academic free speech and free speech on campus, although it does do that. I think the main reason it'll make a difference is because it introduces two enforcement mechanisms. So one is the appointment of a director of free speech and academic freedom to the Office for Students at director level. And it also will introduce a new statutory tort whereby if you're a student or an academic who believes that your speech rights have been breached by your university, you'll be able to take your university to the county court. And the latter has been particularly controversial, and it's caused probably the most heated debate in the House of Lords, certainly during the second reading debate. And the government put forward a compromise to try and get the peers on side, whereby it proposed watering down the tort. So you would have to exhaust the university's internal complaints procedure, then exhaust the OFS's new complaints procedure before you could take your university to court, which we thought was far too great a concession to the bill's critics. And rather luckily, the Lords rejected this compromise and just voted to strip the tort out altogether. So when the bill went back to the Commons, they decided to put the tort back in. And I think it will now go back to the Lords, and I fear that the Lords may say, oh, well, in that case, we'll accept the compromise. Can we have Earl Howe's amendment back, please? And I hope the government, if the Lords do that, won't accept that compromise. I think the problem with the compromise is that we know from experience that the university complaints procedures are interminable. Why should an academic whose reputation has been besmirched, who's been accused of some terrible thought crime, why should they have to wait years before they can clear their name and effectively put their career on hold? If they can take their university to court straight away, then they can get justice far more quickly. And of course, the threat that they will be able to do that, I think, will stay the hand of universities, will be slightly less likely to place academics under investigation merely for challenging the prevailing orthodoxy in one of these critical areas. One of the objections in the Lords was that this is a doubling up. We don't need two enforcement mechanisms. One should be enough. The OFS, Director of Academic Freedom and Free Speech, that will be enough. Why are you over-gilding the lily by introducing this new statutory tort as well? Universities will have their hands full dealing with vexatious complaints in the county court. Incidentally, at the moment, you can take a university to court if you think it's breached your speech rights and the conclusion of an investigation has gone the wrong way. But the only way to do it is to take the university to the High Court to threaten to judicially review the university, which is an expensive and time-consuming process. And we know that because we took Essex University to the High Court and tried to judicially review one of their policies. I'll come on to that very shortly. The problem, I thought, in part, with the objection that you don't need two enforcement mechanisms, one is enough, why saddle universities with having to cope with being sued in the county court, is, well, if they're really concerned about that, those issues, why didn't they complain when the Equality Act was going through Parliament in 2009, 2010? That created not only, first of all, there was already the equivalent of the regulator, the OFS, in the kind of equalities arena, which is the Equality and Human Rights Commission. But in addition, the tort it created, whereby if university employees felt that the university hadn't done enough to protect them from harassment or discrimination, they could take their university to court, sue them in the employment tribunal, that was far more momentous than the tort being introduced by the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill. So there was a doubling up when the Equality Act was going through Parliament. There was a tort which resulted in many court cases being brought against universities, almost not a word of criticism, because it was with the grain instead of against the grain. We hope that if the bill eventually reaches the statute books in its current form, if it isn't amended in the Lords, or if it is, the government rejects it, then we hope that will marginally improve the situation in England's universities, at least. But, and it's a big but, we are concerned that all the benefit resulting from the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill will be negated, and then some, by the Worker Protection Bill. And I'm sure that even though you should all know about this because it will affect the higher education sector, I don't suppose any of you do. Almost nobody does. It's gone completely under the radar. So it's a private member's bill that was proposed by Wira Hobhouse, a Lib Dem MP, and it's being backed by the government. So it's sailed through its first reading in the House of Commons, its first reading in the Lords, second reading in the Commons, report stage in the Commons, about to have its second reading in the Lords. It is sailing through with the government's support. And what the Worker Protection Bill does is it extends liability for employers to for third-party harassment. So as things stand, employers are only liable if one of their employees is harassed by another employee. But under this, and as a result, you know, they've gone to enormous lengths to try and limit their liability. They're supposed to take all reasonable steps to protect their employees from being harassed by other employees, and that includes banning certain words and phrases, sending the staff on unconscious bias training courses, insisting that everyone wear gender pronouns and lanyards and the rest of it. That compliance culture that has spread like topsy throughout workplaces across the United Kingdom is all to do with all originates with the Equality Act 2010. That compliance culture is about to extend way beyond workplaces, because in future, if this bill is passed, employers will be liable not just for the harassment of their employees by other employees, but by members of the public they come into contact with in the course of their employment. Now, I think the intention, the thinking behind this, is that we need employers to do more to protect their employees from being sexually harassed by members of the public. And the bill really originated, the kind of momentum for the bill, with the President's Club scandal in 2018, when some hostesses employed by a charity were harassed by attendees at this fundraising event, some of them big cheeses, and a couple of undercover reporters wrote about what it was like to be a hostess at this event, there was nothing the hostesses could do other than complain to the press, because the charity, as their employer, wasn't liable for the sexual harassment they'd had to endure from the attendees at this event, who, from an Equality Act point of view, were just members of the public. So the thinking, the impetus behind this change to the law is understandable. Employers should do more to protect their employees from sexual harassment from third parties. But this bill doesn't just do that. It extends liability for all kinds of harassment, not just sexual harassment by third parties. So for instance, at the moment, an employer can be sued by their employee if one of their employees overhears a conversation between two other employees in which somebody says something, not directed at them, but which they find upsetting or offensive. There is a case in the Employment Tribunal in which a Nigerian woman overheard another employee saying to a friend, I think if immigrants can't find work, they should go home. And the Nigerian employee who overheard the conversation sued her employer for harassment, for not doing enough to protect her from overhearing this upsetting conversation, and the Employment Tribunal upheld her complaint and awarded her £1,000 in damages. So what that means is, what that precedent means is, that if you're a barmaid in a pub, once this bill becomes law, and you overhear a couple of punters in the pub having a conversation in which they're engaging in a bit of ribald banter, telling saucy jokes, she could legitimately complain to the publican that he hasn't done enough to protect her from overhearing this banter. In order to avoid that, in order to limit their liability, publicans, once it becomes law, will have to employ banter bouncers. We'll have to put up notices saying no banter. They'll have to police conversations that their employees might overhear that they're likely to find upsetting or offensive in virtue of their protected characteristics or in virtue of somebody else's protected characteristics. It's a very broad law. And the compliance culture, the dogmatism, the lack of nuance, the failure to understand context and complexity, which we find in workplaces up and down the country as a result of the Equality Act being passed in 2010, that culture is about to be extended not just to pubs, but to restaurants, to hotels, to football clubs. If you're a woman wearing an adult human female t-shirt You won't be admitted to a hotel because there might be a trans employee in that hotel who would find the message on that T-shirt offensive. So it would be responsible of employers to limit their liability to say, if you have any badge on expressing a contentious political point of view or a T-shirt, or even if we've done some research on you, some background research, and we know that you're likely to express a contentious point of view that one of our members of staff might find upsetting, you're banned. And if we let you in and you say anything that upsets a member of our staff or says something remotely contentious that could expose us to a case, you're banned. You're permanently banned. In a football ground, if a football fan shouts at the linesman, "Are you blind?" and a partially sighted steward overhears him, he could sue the football club for not doing more to protect him from being harassed in virtue of his protected characteristic. So that will mean no banter in football grounds, which I'm sure Roger can tell you will very much change the experience. But how does this affect universities? Well, the one case we've been involved with in which we tried to judicially review a university was the University of Essex. University of Essex no-platformed two gender-critical feminists about 3 years ago. Because the argument was allowing them to speak on our campus could upset some of our trans staff members, our non-binary staff members, and under the Equality Act we have a duty to protect them from experiencing that kind of harassment. They'd misunderstood the Equality Act, because the Equality Act as written doesn't extend to third parties and visiting speakers of third parties. The universities don't have a responsibility to no-platform people who are likely to say things that upset their members of staff with protected characteristics, because they're not liable for third-party harassment as things stand. And Essex misunderstood this, and an equalities barrister called Akaya Reindorf wrote a report called the Reindorf Report, in which she said about their policy, "In my view, the policy states the law as Stonewall would prefer it to be rather than the law as it is." So typically Stonewall, and I think Essex was a member of the Stonewall Diversity Champion Scheme, overstate just what speech the Equality Act restricts. They overstate the responsibility of universities to police the speech of external speakers by exaggerating the scope, deliberately, I think, possibly not deliberately, misinterpreting the Equality Act. And in the past, they've claimed it extends to your responsibility to protect your employees, extends to protecting them from hearing hurty words from external speakers. It doesn't. It didn't. And we won that case. But it will. It will if the Worker Protection Bill becomes law. Henceforth, when a group of trans rights activists on campus say, "You can't invite Kathleen Stock onto our campus because you have a responsibility, if some of them are members of the university staff, to protect us from hearing these profoundly upsetting and offensive opinions, which we feel put our lives in danger," the university will have to take that complaint seriously. And it'll be very difficult for gender-critical feminists, anyone who holds contentious views in this narrow cluster of opinions, will find it very difficult, I think, to be invited onto university campuses. Now, the government has introduced a few exemptions which they think will protect visiting speakers, but we don't think it will. Another way in which the Worker Protection Bill will profoundly affect life on campus, across the United Kingdom, not just in England, is that at the moment, universities aren't liable if their employees feel harassed by things students say to them. That's third-party harassment. From the Equality Act's point of view, at present, students, like visiting speakers, are third parties, and liability of employers does not extend to third-party harassment. If the Worker Protection Bill goes through, then it will. And that will mean universities have a responsibility to protect their employees from being harassed by students. And that doesn't just mean sexual harassment, it doesn't just mean what we commonly think of as harassment, it means things like saying things that activist members of staff find disagreeable. It'll be much easier, I think, to get rid of difficult students like this young autistic man, first guy in his family to go to university in future, because of this change to the Equality Act. So, I mean, the extraordinary thing about the government getting behind the Worker Protection Bill is that they're sort of, on the one hand, increasing protections for free speech on campus and telling universities they need to do more to defend free speech on campus. There is a problem, you need to address it, and if you don't, these are the various penalties you might suffer. But on the other hand, they're also saying you need to do more to protect your staff from harassment, and harassment includes overhearing things they may find disagreeable or offensive. So it's as though the government is placing universities in a cleft stick and imposing conflicting duties on them. I mean, one of the more coherent, I thought, objections to the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill was produced by the Russell Group, which said, if you pass this new law, we'll have conflicting duties when it comes to our public sector equality duty, observing the Equality Act 2010, and observing this new law. Well, I think they had a point, but boy, will they have a point when the Worker Protection Bill is passed, because then they really will have conflicting duties. How do you simultaneously protect people's right to say things that some people are going to find offensive and upsetting and disagreeable, and at the same time fulfill your duty to protect members of your staff from hearing anything they might find upsetting, offensive, or disagreeable? Anyway, because of its profound implications for not just the hospitality sector, the sports sector, but also for universities, we are urging the government to press pause so all the stakeholders affected by the Worker Protection Bill can be properly consulted about it, because I don't think they've thought the implications through. I mean, just give you one final example. Employees of the emergency services will in future, if this bill becomes law, have to be protected from harassment they might experience by people they're engaging with, members of the public they're engaging with. So if a fireman is rescuing a woman from a burning building and she says something disagreeable, if he's wearing a rainbow badge, she turns to him and says, "Oh, you're not gay, are you?" He could sue the fire service for not doing more to protect him, if he's gay in particular, from that kind of harassment. The police, if they, in the course of trying to arrest somebody, are insulted, if someone throws out a racial epithet at a black policeman, he could sue his employer for not doing more to protect him from that kind of harassment. So what are employers going to do? Are the emergency services going to have to carry out risk assessments before responding to 999 calls, as people are murdered and burned to death while they go through the forms and say, "Have we done enough to protect our employees from potentially being harassed by these people they're arresting or rescuing?" People are under extreme stress often when they're dealing with members of the emergency services, and they're likely to breach various speech codes and rules, more likely than in the normal course of events. So I don't quite see how that's going to work, and I don't think the government have thought it through, and that's why we think they should at the very least be a proper consultation about the Worker Protection Bill. Anyway, I've spoken for long enough, so if you have any questions, about 10 minutes.
Thanks, Toby, excellent timing. Just before we carry on, I'll just tell you how it's going to go. George will say a few words of thanks in a minute. We have a AGM after this, so non-members will have to go and hand their badges back to Cheryl on the way out. So that's how it's going to go for the next few minutes. Any questions for Toby? Ken.
I'm a graduate of here at Guy's Hospital, and I don't know where this situation occurred about 4 years ago. Thomas Guy, who was the founder of the hospital in the early 18th century, has a statue in our courtyard. And there was a complaint about this, that this man had supported slavery and therefore his statue should be taken down, rather than the Colson situation in Bristol. But what the complainants did not realise was that Thomas Guy was in no way owning plantations or anything like that. It's rather like him having the equivalent of unit trust in those days that existed, and that some of his money had been invested in companies which were involved. And anyway, and you will find some of the guy's statue is still standing. I'm very pleased about that, as a graduate of this establishment. But the point I want to make is the ignorance of the people making the complaints and the fact that they're not really looking at the evidence before they complain. And I think this is a major problem. Would you like to comment?
Yes, no, I think that's, I think I agree with you. It's, I mean, one of the things I don't understand about campaigns to pull down statues of people who are tainted by association, however slight, with the slave trade, is that it's as though they want to airbrush Britain's past. They want to exclude from Britain's history the evidence that some prominent public figures who made an enormous contribution to public life in their day were in some way linked to the slave trade. But in the very next breath, they want to persuade you that Britain, in the fairly recent past, was a racist hellscape in which everyone was implicated in the slave trade. Economically, we wouldn't have been able to lead the Industrial Revolution had it not been for our exploitation of slaves and the rest of it. It's sort of slightly schizophrenic. It's like thinking about this in connection with the sanitization of the Bond novels, which is a kind of, it comes from the same place. You know, it's like, what, if you're a kind of social justice warrior, why would you want to make this kind of patrician, hard-drinking, misogynistic, probably racist old Etonian more acceptable? Why would you want to kind of smooth away his rough edges? Don't you want people to be offended by this ghastly representative of this kind of desiccated ancien regime? You know, it's just sort of bizarre. Why do they want to pretend he was nicer, whilst at the same time condemning everything he represented? It's sort of, it's as though they haven't quite thought it through. And I suppose what it really boils down to is there's a great passage in 1984 in which Orwell talks about the party constantly changing the historical record. And it's not only a way of trying to control the present to try and make certain points of view, certain attitudes taboo, and to enforce speech codes and unwritten blasphemy laws. It's also just a brutal exercise of power. We are so supreme, we are so powerful, we can even tear down the statue of Thomas Guy outside Guy's hospital. It's like a sort of, it's a way of advertising just how powerful they are as a way of intimidating anyone from challenging them in any way. That's my reading of it. It's Orwellian.
Toby, I went to Durham University.
Ah.
First edition of Private Eye, and I'm probably on the autistic scale, so you can probably guess the nature of the sort of question I might ask. Firstly, I've assumed that you're dashing back to make a programme about why Mark Stein should not have been booted out of GPS News. That's my assumption. You can perhaps add what you're saying. The main question, though, is if you happen to believe that anthropogenic climate change is not the mechanism of climate change, and you want to put a different point of view, and you want that to be on the BBC, how would you go about it?
Yeah, that's, well, it would help if you were a 14-year-old girl who was bunking off school, but it's certainly very difficult, as I'm sure you know. I think in 2017, the BBC changed its editorial policy. Up until that point, if it was discussing climate change, it felt, because of its obligation to be impartial and even-handed, it felt it had to have people on both sides of that debate. But in 2017, they decided the science is settled. This is no longer a debate. Anyone challenging the anthropomorphic climate change wisdom, conventional wisdom, is a denier, putting them on the same kind of place as a Holocaust denier. So it's very difficult, I think, to get on the BBC if you are a dissenter. But there are still, I mean, I think the good news is that mainstream media companies like the BBC, but not just the BBC, CNN, the New York Times, the Guardian, the Washington Post, are hemorrhaging readers, partly because they won't debate these issues which aren't settled and which people are very interested in and there's a great public appetite for. And that's created an opening for people like me to create alternative publications like The Daily Skeptic. You can certainly publish your sceptical views about anthropogenic global warming in The Daily Skeptic.
Well,
Sorry, Toby, it's on the edge of what you said, but it's going back to the beginning, and because of your link with the media, and that is that the media, especially the BBC, always felt they had to put two points of view, didn't they, at one point? And I listened to something during the long pandemic, and they had this really top virologist speak. He was at the University in Israel. And then they said, well, thank you for your view, but now we're going to have another view. And the other view was somebody who wasn't even an expert in virology. So my question to you is, sometimes the media fuel misinformation by feeling they've got to put two points of view without having choice of people who really got the authenticity to say what they're speaking about.
Yes. Well, one difficulty with if you do feel you have an obligation as a broadcaster licensed by Ofcom to put both points of view, often amongst the experts, the credentialed professoriate, there is only one point of view. I mean, one of the things I found particularly surprising as I've worked with people who find themselves in trouble at universities for saying the wrong thing, is that you would expect that as you go higher up the kind of knowledge food chain, and as you encounter more and more intelligent people, you'd expect to find more critical thinking, more dissent, a broader and broader range of diverse opinions. But counterintuitively, the higher you go up the knowledge food chain, the more credentialed the expert is, the less likely they are to dissent from the kind of prevailing point of view within their institution, within their class. And we very much saw that during the COVID debate, or during the government's pandemic response. There was an extraordinary amount of uniformity amongst the kind of educated elite all over the world. You know, they all embraced the lockdown policy, they all embraced the rollout of the vaccines, they all embraced masking. Some of them wore two or even three masks to advertise just how behind the mask mandates they were. They more or less all embraced vaccine passports. We saw that policy being imposed on universities, in universities up and down the country. I don't think there wasn't a Sweden in the kind of British higher education sector which went against the grain. They all embraced mask mandates and vaccine passports. And I think that's the difficulty that the BBC has when it wants to try and find someone with a counter-narrative point of view about something like the government's pandemic response, whether the test and trace programme was effective, what the evidential basis for masking is. It's really hard to find a credentialed expert, a member of the kind of international professoriate, who has a dissenting point of view. Yeah. Well, I'd have two responses to that. The first is, I think the cost of suppressing free speech is nearly always higher than the cost of allowing it. And a good example is the outbreak of COVID-19 in Wuhan in late 2019. Various doctors who raised the alarm and said, we think there is a new SARS-like virus which is causing this particularly virulent type of pneumonia. And this, we need to investigate this, and until we do, we should quarantine our city. They were immediately rounded up by the Chinese authorities, charged with antisocial behaviour, and silenced. Had they not been, then maybe the outbreak could have been contained in Wuhan. But I think the other response, probably the more philosophical response, is that I don't think you can determine how robustly you uphold rights by doing a kind of cost-benefit analysis of the effect of upholding those rights. Remember, this came up when I was studying rights-based utilitarianism as an undergraduate. And the counter-argument is, you know, the rights-based utilitarianism argument is that we should uphold rights because it's going to maximise utility. But you can easily find examples where upholding rights doesn't maximise utility. So, for instance, if there's a spate of murders in your small community, you could justify arresting an innocent man and charging him and imprisoning him for those murders as a way of trying to deter the person who is actually murdering people from committing any more murders. So from a cost-benefit point of view, from a maximising utility point of view, it would be justified in breaching that person's rights. And that's the problem, I think, with all consequentialist efforts to justify rights. You have to think of them as just things we're protected by in virtue of being sentient human beings, and not things that are contingent upon whether protecting them is going to maximise utility or going to be justifiable on a cost-benefit basis.
Yeah, that's very complex. Sorry. I think in more simple terms, where you put it there that you've been offended by somebody saying something. Now, maybe that person who said that was not aware that what was saying on the face. So maybe there's room for education on both sides in order for free speech to really be accepted as free speech.
Yes, and I don't think there ought to be any legal prohibitions on being offensive, and I don't think there should be. I don't think people should jeopardise their livelihoods or risk membership of institutions by being offensive. I don't think anyone has a right not to be offended, but I'm all in favour of people being courteous and polite and behaving in a respectful way. And if people don't realise that using certain words, certain phrases, behaving in a certain way is profoundly offensive to some people, then making them aware of that might be a good thing, yes.
One last question.
Thank you. I'm Terry Friedman. I'm not an academic. I'm an ex-teacher, now a freelance blogger and journalist. I just wondered, I loved higher education, but I find myself in a position now being very loath to suggest to younger people that they go to university unless they wish to pay a small fortune to have their existing fees confirmed. Now, I'd like to know that's wrong, but your sister organisation called FIRE in America publishes a league table, kind of free speech league table, of the best and the worst universities to go to, where you're likely to be covered for having dissent or expressing dissenting views. I just wondered if that's something that the Free Speech Union does or has thought of doing, or is there a problem with doing that?
Yeah, no, we have thought about doing that. Spiked did it for a few years, and Civitas has just started to do it. The reason we decided not, I met with the chap at Spiked who'd overseen Spiked's ranking of universities in Britain according to how well they protected free speech. He's now the editor of Spiked, Tom Slater. And he said, well, it was a bit of a nightmare. It was a nightmare because, first of all, it's incredibly labour-intensive. You need enormous resources if you're going to look at all, 130 UK universities. But in addition, the FIRE survey is a paper, a desktop survey. So they don't actually look, they don't interview students, they don't do any polling. I mean, the ranking might be affected if there's been a high-profile, no-platforming incident, but what they look at is how robust the policies of the university in question is, and that's not always a perfect guide to, because as we found in many cases, free speech policies are more observed in the breach, sorry, are more honoured in the breach than the observance. And he said that the other problem is that there is no kind of clear consensus about how you measure free speech on universities. I mean, I think there's a problem with measuring it by looking at how many people have been no-platformed, for the reasons I articulated, and I think how many people are engaging in self-censorship is probably a better measure. But there are also other ways of measuring it. People define free speech differently. Often an argument you hear for restricting the speech of cishet white males is if you restrict their speech, then historically disadvantaged groups are going to be able to enter the conversation, speak more freely. And that's the argument for excluding, in some cases, cishet white males from attending certain conferences, from coming to certain venues. The idea is that by excluding them, by not allowing them to participate, you're increasing, it's going back to this kind of cost-benefit utility maximisation argument, that if you're allowing other people, historically disadvantaged groups, to speak more freely, if they're speaking up, if they're participating, and they wouldn't as much if cishet white males were, then by restricting the speech of cishet white males, you're actually increasing the kind of net quantity of free speech. So because of the kind of arguments, because it's not clear exactly how you'd measure free speech, because of the expense, because it's so time consuming, we decided not to do it. But we did think about it quite seriously.
Thank you. Well, apologies to anybody who didn't get a question in. I'd just like to ask George, as Deputy President, say a few words of thanks.
This podcast was produced in association with youthpublicationslimited.com.